Eli's real mad today.
I am mad today. Today's an angry day for Eli.
Why is that?
My motorcycle that I just got and I'm trying to learn how to ride properly won't start.
Yeah.
It's got gremlins.
It's got something. Yeah. It's been quite a path.
Yeah.
To get it running, and now it's running and it won't run.
Yeah, you've been on hand for some of this adventure, and it's been a little frustrating.
Well, now
I have some ideas.
Yeah, what's your ideas?
Well, me being not mechanically inclined in any way.
Your ideas means a mechanic's ideas that he told you, by the way.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't know what I'm doing. But
I assumed it was something entirely different.
But I'm going to have to learn, because apparently motorcycles take a lot of little... You know, you need a ratchet set.
Yeah, especially when you buy them for like $1,900 and they're 24 years old.
Yeah. You know.
It's rough.
I think I knew what I was getting into. I can do it. It's going to require me taking things off that I just learned what they're called.
And then I'm going to... how they function.
Yeah, I'm going to say it. Like, I know what I'm talking about more.
It's worked for me so far.
Well, what you... My,
you ask me questions.
Yeah.
I go, well, I know the phrases.
And there are times when I ask you a question, I'm like, I'm not getting, like, the deep, true, I've known this for years answer.
Because I don't know it now.
Yeah. And I do respect that. And that does work. I'm going to see if I can do that to keep me on two wheels.
I don't know, man. It's going to take a minute. You need a new seat. You need a new air filter.
Well, my air filter's wet.
Your filter's very wet.
That's a problem right there.
Man, at least it's not dumping gasoline anymore.
It's like having mud in the tires.
You know what's nice when you're bummed out?
No.
Comedy.
That's true.
That was a great transition.
Very true, Sam. Nice work.
Yeah, and this is an episode about comedy. With the comedian.
I'm also kind of mad I missed this one.
Yeah, you did. Casey Rocket. We did it in a hotel room at a Holiday Inn in Fairfield, Ohio. He was on a, I think, 40-city headlining tour. And that was very convenient because he came through Cincinnati.
I had to stack kiwi that day.
Yeah.
They needed me to stack a lot of
kiwi. And I needed to talk to Casey. I went into this, like, not confident about my ability to talk.
Yeah.
No energy. No nothing. Yeah. But it worked itself out, man. I'm happy with where we got in the conversation. I think we covered some funny stuff.
You did.
But yeah, you heard it, luckily.
It was very good. And I'm not just saying that as an LFDW kind of guy.
What we're doing is we're putting this one second so that you're like, oh, that was a good one. And then you'll forgive like two or three later that weren't as good. Mm-hmm. But you're going to be too hooked.
That is the ruse we're employing. Yes.
But yeah, we talked about comedy. We got into the idea of comedy as like art and creation and tension and sadness and all those things. If you don't know who Casey is, he is a absurdist comedian, for lack of a better term. A lot of what he does is, as he calls it, riffing. He has a joke that I really like where he'll be in the middle of talking about something and he'll drop like a Ziploc bag of fake jewels.
Okay.
And then he'll be like, oh, I dropped my rubies and gems, pick it up and go, I'm very rich, and continue with his joke.
See, I love that.
And I like that joke.
Yeah.
If you Google him, the AI things are like, what the fuck's up with Casey Rockets? And it's just Reddit thread after Reddit thread of people being like, I don't get what's going on here. But like, as I pointed out in the episode, if Reddit was around in 1978,
shit we would know.
No one would have gotten, oh my god, not Andy Warhol, the comedian, not Andy Samberg.
Oh geez, you're the wrestler.
The wrestler.
That I can't think of either.
I say Kaufman. His name Andy Kaufman.
We just forgot the name Andy Kaufman.
I always go Warhol and Samberg. I've been having that problem for like a month now.
I do Andy Samberg and Kaufman too. I get that confused.
It's all, so, I think it's because they're both Jews.
You people,
I can say it.
You people are all.
But, you know, this is a
good,
solid episode.
Yeah. I wish I was here for this one. Yeah. He talked about like some of the sobriety conversation. Didn't get too heavy on anything, but
yeah, I don't have as much on that. But we touch on a lot of very, very interesting stuff, at least in my opinion. I found him because he just started buying our shit, and then someone told me about it, and I was like, oh, hey, no way. And that was pretty cool. If you've seen him and don't know that you've seen him, it was on probably Kill Tony, which is the Tony Hinchcliffe show. Casey is from Austin, and he works the Mothership quite a bit. He talks about coming up from being a doorman there and being able to do an hour headline. But you look him up and you'll be like, oh, that guy, when you see his face. If you do know who he is, and a lot of people who have heard about this have been stoked that we did this episode.
Of course.
I don't have to explain him to you. And as he would say, and as you'll find out, he won't explain himself to you either.
It's only fair.
Yeah. So, you know, here's Casey Rocket. But before we... is it Casey Rocket or Casey Rockets? I say it both ways.
I think it's Rockets.
But before we get to the episode, we have a number of events coming up, and we're going to push them on every podcast.
Yep.
we have a bike show on May 17th. We have three swap meets going on May 4th, July 6th, August 20th. All those events are at Southgate House in Newport, Kentucky. They were put on with us, Southgate, Biker Central, which is across the street from Southgate, and Broken Bolt Cycles, who are our mechanics and the people that are going to solve Eli's bike issue. But they're a little bit backed up right now, and Eli's impatient.
I am very impatient.
But anyway.
Yeah, this is a good conversation. Enjoy.
Here's Casey Rocket. Rockets.
I'm your black cat, baby.
Hot start.
But I did very little research on you.
Sure. Why not?
The AI answer on Google about you said that you overcame a Bud Ice addiction in college.
Oh, that's so funny. So what did you type in?
I typed in Casey Rockets.
Casey Rockets explained.
And then it has that whole fucking thing that's like, the weird shit about that is if I type in my own company, which I do all the time, mm-hmm. it gives answers that I haven't told anyone.
Things from your childhood you have never muttered.
Things from my fucking head that I'm planning that like I haven't told people I'm planning.
He will be in a car accident in 2 weeks. He will lose the use of his left arm. Oh no, I gotta stay away from cars.
I keep changing my pattern of life just to try and like go back to Google and type it in and be like, is it still fucking there?
Nobody throws off the algorithm, my friend. The algorithm has your whole life planned for you and not a moment.
Did you overcome a Bud Ice addiction?
I used to drink an incorrigible. They used to call me La Infant Terrible. I used to drink so much Bud Ice. Well, I'm an alcoholic. And when I was younger, I probably from age, it was mostly just college. So it was 18 to 21. I would have probably 16 to 25 Bud Ice a day. And I
always Bud Ice?
Always Bud Ice.
Okay.
And the bottles, if you get the bottles real cold, ooh, it's like you're not, it's like you're drinking water. They go right down. Oh, even the thought of a Bud Ice is making me smile. I would drink an incredible amount of Bud Ice.
Overcame that?
And I overcame that against all odds. And every 2 years, like clockwork, I go right back to it. So I didn't, oh no, what's happening? Yeah, sorry. I ruined your toy. You think it's broken?
No, it's still green.
God damn it.
It's still going.
I ruined your special toy. I was eating pumpkin seeds before we started talking. One got in my throat. I had 10 gumballs last night. I ate 10 gumballs.
At the same time?
Come on, man. No, one at a time. Come on, man. It's the pumpkin seed. No, I got done with the shows and I sat down and I had 5 crybaby gumballs and I had 5 cotton candy Hubba Bubba. It was the best night ever. I digress.
Just but, at the club?
No, we went to a gas station and they had a really cool selection of gumballs. Right there, read them and weep. There's a paper trail. Yeah, well, I was sober from 21 to 25 And then I got back on the butt ice for a couple months during COVID. And since then, every couple years, I'll have a day. I'll have a day where I'll go back to the butt ice, and then I'll wake up and I'll go, that's not me anymore. I'm not the butt ice man.
That day?
Typically, it's a couple days.
Okay.
go on a little bender, then I'll wake up. And it's harder every time as you get older. Your body doesn't process the liquor and drugs like it used to.
I woke up this morning hungover from not drinking.
Yeah.
I'm 28. I just woke up and I was like, oh, fuck.
Yeah. It's brutal. It's a thankless job. Yeah, some days you just feel hungover anyway.
I watched a movie until about 11:15, and that was too late.
What movie?
What I watch?
A Pirate's Life for Me.
Crimes of Passion.
Oh, cool.
With Kathleen Turner.
Never seen it. Crimes of the Future. David Cronenberg.
No.
That's fine.
Videodrome.
That's fine, too.
That's the only Cronenberg that doesn't fucking terrify me.
I just saw Dead Ringers 2 weeks ago. They had it in theaters for some reason in Texas. And that's a good one.
It's the shit seeing stuff on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
We do that once a month.
That's awesome.
Have you ever seen Cruising with Al Pacino?
You know what? Someone just told me to watch that, where he's undercover in like the gay scene.
Yeah, was that's it so me cool. on my Instagram?
No, my buddy was watching it. I might have saw it there too. Yeah,
because I recently posted a video about The Exorcist and just turned it into an ad for Cruising.
Yeah, I went and saw Seven in theaters like 3 weeks ago. The David Fincher. Oh, so great. Kevin Spacey, so chilling.
That's a heavy one.
Yeah, that was awesome. The dialogue is so great.
In Cruising, a guy gets fisted on screen.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Is it Al Pacino?
No, but you do see him hogtied at one point. So that's fun.
So is he undercover in the sense of that? I guess you shouldn't spoil it, but is he like hooking up with guys?
So there's a serial killer
mm-hmm.
Who's killing gay guys. And it's based off sure. of, if you've seen The Exorcist, there's a scene where she gets like some kind of medical procedure done. They put a tube in her neck. And the people doing it were real NYU medical center staff.
And one of them was a serial killer.
One of them was a real serial killer. Mm. His name is Paul Bateson.
Mm-hmm.
And he killed somewhere between like 5 and 12 people.
Wow.
And he, in the underground gay New York S&M scene, he cut them up and he put their bags and bodies that were marked NYU Medical Center, which was not the smartest fucking decision. And then they went to the NYU Medical Center and they were like, hey, who's the only gay guy here? And they went, Paul Bateson. And it was him. And they had him confess to a bunch of other murders to reduce his sentence. Then Whoa. William Friedkin made the movie Cruising, which is based off of that and a book.
Oh, and he's also the guy who did The actress. That's interesting. Yeah, I didn't realize that.
Because he found out that story, and he was like, whoa.
That's interesting.
I was recently approached to make a very similar fucking movie.
Yeah.
And Al Pacino leaves his wife, Karen Allen, who's in Scrooged. she is. It's a good movie.
Naturally.
And he goes undercover to all these like clubs, like the Mineshaft and Ramrod, which are real places. And everyone in there is real. And all the stuff that's happening is real.
Oh, wow.
And he tries to find the serial killer as he progressively maybe gets gayer.
You're too close to this one.
Like, literally, he comes back at one point. She's like, you don't want to sleep with me anymore. He's like, the job's affecting me.
There's so many hot dudes.
And they all want to dance on ether. And like half the movie's him dancing with guys on ether, then going back to Karen Allen and either fucking her or not fucking her. Then maybe he becomes
like,
a serial killer.
Kind of how Mindhunter, like half the episodes are just about that guy eating pussy. You're
yeah.
Like, what does this have to do with with
serial killing?
Yeah, with serial killing and understanding criminal profiling.
All I know is that Cruising was not very popular with the gay community.
They thought it was exploitative or
they
something?
They thought it was, yeah.
Exploitative?
Wait,
they would huff ether?
Yeah, so there's like awesome. A scene, you know how bandanas are a big thing in the 80s gay community?
Sure.
Right, everyone knows.
Oh, and they would huff?
It would be That's a to signify, like at one point in the movie he has a yellow bandana, and a guy comes up to him and he's like, you like golden showers? And he's like, no, I like the watch. And the guy's like, then take that off, you fucking asshole. So bandanas would signify what you were into.
Whoa.
And they would also be covered in ether. So where you were dancing,
you could huff it and signify that you wanted to get pissed off.
Wow, that's amazing. That's so interesting. I didn't know, like, a lot of poppers, like, because sometimes if I go on like a serious bender, I'll always end up at the smoke, like day three bender, I'm at the smoke shop. I'm getting like poppers, I'm getting whippets. And some poppers, like the Rush, are just ether. Because I used to huff ether when I was a teenager. So
you would relate to this movie.
I bet I would. Yeah. I also used to get pissed on for cash.
He wasn't getting paid.
He's doing it pro bono. Well, that's the long arm of law. Sometimes it takes getting pissed on to solve a case.
Well, sometimes it takes getting hogtied to solve a case, too. Then you get the wrong guy. There's an incredible brutal scene with a massive black guy, like 6'8", shredded, cowboy hat, jock strap, black cowboy boots.
Whoa.
Walks in, slaps the shit out of Pacino, walks out, doesn't say a word.
Walks into the club or like a hotel?
Walks into like a police interrogation. And then he does it to the other guy they're interrogating. And the guy just looks up and goes, "Who the fuck's that guy?" And it gets me every time. But that's a real thing they would do. So that when the people went to testify,
yeah,
the judge would be like, "Who hit you?" And he'd be like, "A giant black guy in a cowboy hat, jock strap, and black boots." And the judge would be like, "You're insane."
Whoa. Whoa. So they would make him look like cartoonish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't hold up.
He had a spinner hat on.
One of the fucking propeller hats that kids wear.
He had a dunce cap on. He had Pavliacci makeup. Oh, that's haunting.
And that happened. Like, that's a real thing that Friedkin took from, like, knowing detectives. They were like, "Hey, we do this." And he was like, "Fucking perfect." That's incredible.
That's wacky. Yeah.
Are you a Kratom guy at all?
I was.
I feel like Whippets and Kratom.
Yeah.
I used to be a Whippet guy, and now I'm a Kratom guy.
Yeah. You know what? I am taking Kratom again. I had stopped. I take it. I've taken it for years. I love it.
It's right good here. That's what that me bottle is.
Yeah. These are Kratoms. Yeah, these things.
See, I like the terrible taste.
Yeah, I did powder for years. The powder, yeah, you start to, it's an acquired taste.
You
it's
wake up in gross the morning, 12 o'clock hits, and you go, "Oh, fucking thank God.
Thank God, it's my Kratom time.
It's my Kratom time. Get a nice cold Kratom you made the night before. Drink it all day."
So tasty. Yeah, sip on your Kratoms.
Why'd you stop?
Well, it's physically addicting, right? So
no, I just feel like I have the flu if I don't drink
it. Yeah, I know. I mean, I've been on it since I was like probably 20 years old. So, I mean, I've taken it for like 10 years. But just, I don't know. I guess I was wanting to see if I would be more creative if I haven't taken it. Like, so I've weaned off at various times, but only for like a week. And then I'd be like, nah, I prefer to be on it. Yeah.
See, I feel like faster on it.
Yeah.
I feel like
quicker, stronger, happier.
Yeah. It cuts down anxiety. Because I was on a bunch of anxiety pills.
Sure.
And they made me almost fail out of college.
Yeah.
And Kratom to me feels like what they always said the pills would feel like.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a fair. You know, I think for me, it's like a lesser of two evils. I can take Kratom.
Yes.
It doesn't really have adverse health effects, except certainly is physically
sometimes
addicting.
Your tummy hurts if you drink too much
sometimes. Yeah, but that's it. And it gets me through the day. I don't need to do my butt ice. I don't need to go out there and get back on the streets and be a little tyrant. I can just take my Kratom and I'm fine, kind of functioning as a normal human being. Yeah,
I feel exactly this is a fucking sponsored by Kratom.
Yeah.
Kratom, buy it at your fucking gas station.
Like if you don't take it, I would not start taking it because it is physically addicting. But for me, it's always been, it's been great. A lot of my friends take it. Yeah.
There's a Hunter Thompson quote. "I wouldn't advocate for drugs, alcohol, or sex, but it's always worked for me."
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know where I would be without it. Yeah. Because it's just enough to get me through the day where it's like, I don't think about doing it.
Like, I used to smoke a ton of weed, and there was a period of time when I lived in San Francisco where I microdosed mushrooms constantly. And, like, once every 2 weeks, I would do, like, a real trip.
Uh-huh.
And I got to the point where there was one day where me and my buddy who I lived with went up to the top of Mount Davidson, which is where that cross is in Dirty Harry, where he stabs the guy.
Mm-hmm.
We lived right on the back side of that.
So sick.
And you're staring up at that cross high, and you're like, whoa, that's a big fucking cross. But we took some mushrooms. They didn't work. So we went back to our house and took a tab of acid, some molly. then we started doing whippets and snorting ketamine.
Sure,
and
naturally.
We watched Israel Adesanya fight Kelvin Gastelum, and I fell asleep sober. And I was like, oh, I'm doing too many drugs.
Well, your body starts fighting it. Yeah, your liver enzymes are just, you're operating at full capacity.
I was like, I shouldn't be good right now.
Yeah, your metabolism's too high.
And now if I smoke weed, I'm like, I can't be around my wife. Like, I can't be around fucking anyone.
Can't be around people I trust.
You know?
Yeah.
But I think every guy, maybe girl, I don't know, needs a vice.
Sure.
Nicotine and kratom.
So. Maybe. Nicotine, kratom. Yeah. A good book. A warm bath. Pressed perks. Yeah. Anything, really. Pressed perks. So tasty.
Do you ever get on nicotine pouches?
Oh, yeah. I do the pouches. Like, what? Just when I'm on the plane, though. Or if I'm in a movie.
Or anywhere you can't have a vape or a cigarette.
Yeah. I mean, I smoke cigarettes, but I can only be outside, you know, if it's cold or whatever. It's just so I can have a continuous stream of nicotine in my body. But, you know, I'm a smoker, yeah.
I love nicotine. I could never develop a habit for cigarettes.
Yeah.
I've tried.
Yeah, some people, yeah. You're better off without it, yeah.
If it didn't give you cancer, I would have Redman or Levi Strauss in 24/7.
Yeah, I chewed when I was a teenager for a period of time. I always enjoyed a nice chew.
Oh, my God.
Big chaw. Yeah, I was my mom's a horse trainer, so I was always on the farm, so I would be spitting and chewing. Big old spit. So sick.
When I was in college, sophomore year, I lived with one of my good friends, and we had a dorm, two beds, and I would always put my entirely full solo cups of dip spit on the tiny bedpost. And then we would have on Wednesday nights, we would drink whiskey and Country Time lemonade and watch Viceland. And every Wednesday night, I would knock that shit everywhere in the fucking dorm room. And then I found out you could put paper towels in there to catch it.
Oh, that makes sense. Life hack.
It's clever if you're fucking dipping in a dorm room. Also, don't spit in your Jack and Coke and run out of fucking, you know, alcohol when you're 18.
Yeah, nobody dips anymore, man. It's a dying breed. Nobody dips.
I've literally gone to a UDF and been like, do you have any, like, loose leaf tobacco? And they look at me like I'm an insane person. And then they dig it out of, like, the back cabinet. It's not in the system. It legitimately has dust on it. And I go, how much is that? And they go, I don't know. And I go, here's $5 for you if you hand me that right now.
Yeah, it's a dying breed. People don't dip anymore. Kids are all on their phones now. Tragic. Kids don't eat candy corns anymore. This is the first time we've met. Have I ever done my impression of Dracula Sebastian Maniscalco for you?
No.
It's pretty good. Kids don't eat candy corns anymore. Nobody knocks on doors anymore. That's pretty good. I can't see myself in the mirror anymore. So cool.
Dude, I'm a big impression fan.
Sure.
And have you ever seen Norm's impressions?
I'm sure I have, yeah.
Like him doing Tarantino.
Uh-huh.
And it's just about how big his head is. Like, size-wise. But it's fucking perfect.
Yeah, they kind of, and From Dusk Till Dawn, have you ever seen that?
Oh, yeah.
You know, when he turns into a vampire, they make his head even bigger. Yeah, which is scary to think. That's the scariest part of the movie.
And he wrote a part for him to...
To lick feet?
Specifically cast 1998 Selma Hayek.
To suck on some toes. Who could blame him? They were so coked out making that movie. They were so visibly blown out. Like, the whole script is so cokey.
The first time I fucking saw it, I was like, I'd forgotten the vampire thing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, cool, Tarantino movie. And then the fucking vampire thing happens. You're like, what in the fucking shit?
What's
like,
going on?
Yeah. They made two movies.
Dude, it's pretty sick. Yeah, I went and saw at the Paramount Theater in Austin, Robert Rodriguez showed it on Halloween, and then he did a Q&A after. It was so cool. I have this old, I have one of the storyboards from the movie. I bought it off eBay. I love that movie.
That's so sick.
It was like $75. But oh, it's pretty cool either way.
It's not that bad.
Not bad. Piece of history. But they have the documentary about it, Full Tilt Boogie, which is him and Clooney and everybody. It's behind the scenes making the movie, and they're just so gacked out. They're so coked out. It's hilarious.
All of them?
Seems like it. Yeah. Because you can see it, because I know during that time period, I mean, I don't know Quentin Tarantino, but I know that they were doing Flow back then. So the time frame adds up that they were all just zootered making this vampire movie, which is pretty cool lore.
I like when people get famous enough that they can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
That's something that fascinates me. Like Bob Dylan, I'm a big fan of him.
Yeah.
And I've heard stories about him just doing whatever the fuck.
Uh-huh.
Like, if he shows up to a show, and if his walk from the bus to the door is more than 25 feet, he'll turn around and leave. And if anyone there is smoking cigarettes, and he smells it, he'll turn around and leave. He smokes cigarettes.
What?
It's not that he's averse to it. I think he's just doing it because he can.
Yeah.
And fucking Tarantino does shit like that, too. Where he's just like, I can.
Yeah.
You'll like it. That shit fucking fascinates me, man.
Yeah, to have he's such a stickler. Yeah, there's stuff with that, like with comedy too. Like bigger, when people become like a theater act or a headliner, like a arena act, and then they go back down to the clubs, right? Because you don't stay at that level forever. They keep those like super Hollywood tendencies. There's a couple people in particular I have in mind, but you get a writer, right?
Right.
Like things you want in your green room. And there's some people who like, I want 20 new white shirts. I want a new pair of Air Force Ones. I want lobster. I want filet mignon. I want vegan chili. I want regular chili. And it's just like,
well, there's 200 people
here. Yeah, it's the Chuckle Hut in Madison, Wisconsin. And you're like, what is, yeah.
It's not the fucking Hollywood Bowl anymore.
No.
Man.
Yeah, they want like a chef. They want all these things. And the club just serves frozen pretzels and chicken fingers. So.
And you have a drink ticket.
Yeah, and you can have as many Red Bulls as you want.
When you're on tour, because it's different than a musician tour, and I don't think people
sure
think about that, right?
Well, we have no instruments, right?
Also, do you have like a crew?
Mm-mm. It's just me. It's just me. And then,
how do you get places? Do you just drive?
I fly.
Okay.
I fly, and then if the cities are close enough, my license is expired. So, but like last year, I would go. If the cities are like back to back to back to back, like I did 11 cities in 11 days in Florida, like those I drove. But typically you have a couple days in between, so you would just fly everywhere. And yeah, there's nothing to bring but your bags because the whole thing is just you with the microphone, you know. So,
and like with your show, is there any consistency to it?
There's a general shell outline, like
you have notes you're trying to hit.
Yeah, like the ending is the same, the first 15 minutes are always different, like different jokes, different riffs, and then there's a couple main stories that I tell, but they're always different too. So there's a general structure, but you could see the 7 o'clock and the 9:30 and it would be maybe 50% different. Yeah.
Do you come up with the stuff that changes on the spot?
Typically, yeah. Just depends. If sometimes it'll be mostly jokes, 80% jokes, and then sometimes it'll be 40% jokes and then 60% improv. It just depends how my brain is working that day, if I'm able to connect the dots non-linearly and pull from the cloud. Because there's a million jokes. So like in the hour, there's hundreds of jokes. So, and most of them are like 5 seconds long.
Yeah.
So it's just little, there's full jokes that are actual traditional joke structure. And then there's just things that are throwaway lines. Some of them are written down, some of them are not.
I feel like most of the stuff that gets clipped is like the improv stuff.
Sure. Well, that's the best stuff to share, because I probably wouldn't do it again anyway. You don't want to share stuff people will see again. Like, we saw that already. Like, it's not like music, you know?
I get, like, it's... And I've been trying to, like, not do this. If I watch, like, a comedian be a guest on Conan or something, I'll be like, well, I saw him do that bit in his special a year later. And I was like, well, it's hard to write stuff.
Sure. Yeah.
A band can play a song. Like, I'm a big fucking Grateful Dead fan. They played certain songs 3,000 times.
Yeah.
And no one was mad about it.
No. So why is it so different? Because we don't have writers. Like, a lot of roast comics have writers. Like, people who do roast stuff. Because for whatever reason, I don't know if it's a time frame thing. I used to do roast battles and stuff. But, like, stand-ups. I mean, I guess it depends. Like, if sometimes you hit a level, comedians, where they get like a 3-special deal with like Netflix, and then they'll like hire writers because they're like, well, I can't come up with a new hour of material in like 6 months or whatever. But when you're just touring around, I mean, you write all your own stuff, you know, obviously. You don't have anybody doing, no one's doing it for you. So. Yeah, of course you reuse a little stuff. Why wouldn't you? Yeah.
I mean, you know, the whole... It's an odd difference between what, like, people, a crowd expects.
Yeah.
You know? Do you ever find that, like, if you end up working for a crowd, they get mad if you don't do something?
Yeah, I mean, because I always do meet and greets after, so sometimes people be like, oh, I wish you did this joke or that joke, and I'll tell them, like, you don't really want that. They don't really want that. They think they do. But you do it, and then you feel in the room an energy change where they go, oh, no. We've seen that before. Because they know the beats of it, right?
Yeah.
And there's only a couple of my jokes that people really remember. Maybe 5, maybe 10. Like, of the bigger jokes, I guess, that did well online or something. But, yeah, I mean, you can't do those jokes. That's what they don't, I want the hour to be completely different than what they've seen. So for that reason, it's, you have to be careful about what you're sharing online and stuff.
If you Google your name, one of the first things that pops up is Reddit threads that are like, can someone explain Casey Rockets to me? how did you, and I don't find that for like Jim Gaffigan.
Sure.
No one's like, hey, can you explain what the fuck he's doing? but I imagine if Reddit was around in like 1978, Jesus Christ, his name is entirely escaping me.
Steve Martin?
No, the other one. The wrestling guy.
Andy Kaufman?
Thank you. I was thinking Andy Samberg, and I was like, it is not fucking Andy. Still, Reddit would have been like, what the fuck's Andy Samberg about?
Yeah. But
in the 70s, people would have been like, can someone fucking explain Andy
Well, there
Kaufman?
Is no explanation, right? And it's things that I think are funny. So, I mean, I don't go up there and I think, oh, I'm going to be subversive about blah, blah, blah. I'm, you know... I mean, I consider myself to be a satirist. So some things I'm doing are making fun of stand-up comedy, certain tropes and things like that. But there's nothing to explain. I'm just kind of being a little stinker.
That's like...
being a brat.
With David Lynch movies, it's the same fucking thing. Like,
yeah.
If you look up Mulholland Drive, people are like, fucking explain this to me.
It's what you assign meaning to it.
And it's like,
yeah.
You can't.
Of course, I think about life in philosophical terms. Of course, I read a lot and things like that. But I don't sit down and go... This is what the hour means to me. This is what the joke structure is meant to represent. I don't know what if comedy even really works like that. There's not some through line of a deeper meaning, except general absurdism.
Who, what comedian, did you always, when did you figure out you wanted to be in comedy? And did you have comedian, like, inspirations that led you down the path to, like, what you do? How'd this happen?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to do comedy from when I was pretty young, but I grew up in a really rural area, so I didn't know anybody who'd ever done stand-up. And then when I was in college at Georgia Southern, there was no, like, improv troupe or anything. It's like a real rural school. So people,
what town
like,
is it in?
Statesboro, Georgia.
Okay.
So there's not, like, an arts community there. So I never met anyone, like, come to comedy group or whatever. Like, that wasn't a thing. So... I was listening to just various different comedy things, like Comedy Bang Bang and things like that.
That's the shit.
It's so funny. And I admire Scott Aukerman so much. And Reggie Watts, I've gotten to know a little bit, and he's always been super nice to me. So, yeah, just people being wacky and zany like that. And I'd never seen anything like that, like characters and things. So I think Comedy Bang Bang was big. So then I started doing the talent show at school and just kind of figuring it out. And it was really similar to what I'm doing now.
How long ago was this?
10 years ago. Okay. I would run around and sing and stuff and say things. But then that wasn't working. So then as time went on, for like maybe the next 2 years, I tried to figure out how to write like one-liners. And I think now it's a mix of the two. Because it's a, you know, it's just riffing. I'm riffing. I might be singing, and then I might do a structured one-liner joke, and then there's a million little jokes, then another one-liner, and then, you know, there is a cadence to it, but it's not written out like that, you know what I mean? It's a rhythm. There's a rhythm to it.
Do you find the rhythm individually, like show to show?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just beats. So some shows I might feel like are a 7 out of 10, and then sometimes it'll be like perfect, you know, firing on all cylinders. And it's just how my brain is working that day.
Does it have to do with the audience at all?
Sure. Yeah. If they're more goofy, like if they're catching on to little things I'm doing that I want them to get and they are getting, then I'll feel more comfortable and that'll get me in a rhythm. Like just some audiences are more maybe laughing in the wrong places.
Yeah,
like maybe they're not really getting what you're trying to deliver. Not to be too vague, but it's hard to even truly even explain. But yeah, like some audiences, you just feel like you're on the same page with them. Like they get what you're trying to present, and then that gives me confidence to keep doing whatever it is I'm doing in that moment.
A lot of like my favorite comedy is wildly inaccessible.
Sure.
Like my favorite, like Mulaney, right? He's an accessible comedian.
Yeah.
Oh Hello is not super accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you grew up in the middle of Alabama, you don't know those fucking people.
Yeah.
You don't get any of the jokes. You know, but I grew up in DC. My mom's from New York. I know all of those fucking people.
Yeah.
Right. So like to me, like a lot of the best comedy isn't accessible to everyone. And when it is accessible, and same shit with music a lot of the time.
For sure.
Like
Commercial
music is dog shit mostly, but it's fucking everywhere.
Yeah.
Same with movies. Cruising is a great movie, and it's way fucking better than Heat. No offense to people that love Heat. Heat's gonna get a lot of fucking... I'm gonna get a lot of heat for that. But, you know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of the... Also most memorable shit is the stuff that is not accessible.
Yeah, well, I think there's a degree of compromise, right? You want a large group of people to be laughing. But I think if you're absolutely crushing, you're not trying hard enough. Because you don't want everyone to be laughing. You want maybe like 60% of them to really like it. And of course, you don't go out and design jokes that way. But I think you need the audience to meet you where you are instead of meeting them where they are, right? So you don't want to do, like, your first idea for a joke typically is too easy. So then you go down, okay, let's make the reference deeper. Instead of talking about Interstellar, maybe I'll talk about Donnie Darko. You know what I'm saying? Like,
there's a Mulaney bit where he, like, tells the Bill Clinton story, but intersperses it with the plot of The Fugitive.
Yeah.
That kind of shit. Like, I love
sure.
that. Where just in the middle, he's like, no, but it's also the ballroom where Harrison Ford comes in. He's, like, referencing the fucking people from 40 years ago, you know?
Yeah, I think if people, and this wasn't always the case, but if someone of any age over 25 maybe went to my show, there would be something in there for everyone. But it was not always like that. And that's not by design. I just think it's gotten more sprawling what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a million different things, whereas maybe it used to be almost all about drugs. Or all about certain niche things. Now it's kind of taken a different turn. But like 5 years ago, if anyone was over the age of like 35, it was like totally silent. So just for whatever reason. And I think I wore it as a badge of honor that no one was laughing. I mean, there was a large part of my life that I purposefully did not want people to laugh.
And you kept getting booked?
to an extent. Like, I lived in Idaho for 3 years and nobody booked me in Idaho. It was not working. Yeah. It just was not working. But Austin is a much more hip.
Where'd you go to Austin?
Cooler city. About 4 years ago. I think it was 2021. Yeah.
When did Rogan open the mothership?
2 years ago.
Because people talk a lot about that being like, Austin's a great comedian town. It's,
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Being a comedian from there?
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, and I was a door guy at the mothership. I was one of the first door guys there. It was 15 of us who were kind of selected to do that. It's the same system as the comedy store. So you're a door guy until you kind of graduate from that. Typically, it's a financial thing where you're a door guy until you don't need the money of being a door guy anymore. So
you decide when you graduate.
Kind of. Yeah. It's a little bit of both. Like the booker, Adam Egit, like you meet with him. And
that guy's fucking fun.
Yeah. He's great, man. Yeah. He's a norm guy. Yeah. He's a great dude. He's
underrated in comedy.
Yeah. He's a great, great guy. He's a good friend of mine. And he's a genius. I mean, he's with the booking. I mean, he sees things in people. People are just like open micers. And he sees things people don't see.
Was he at the comedy store?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was the booker of the comedy store for a long time. And then Rogan brought him to book the club. And there's a misconception about the club that it's all like right-leaning or something, or like insult comics, and most of the door guys are like absurdist comedians, like going up in capes and wearing sunglasses and showing pictures and doing all kinds of wacky shit on stage, which is all Egit. So he sees like kind of where comedy's going, and that is what's happening at the mothership that people don't see,
and it's getting more and more absurdist.
Yeah,
like I mean I think you should leave, and Tim Robinson was a massive fucking hit with shit they wouldn't let him put on SNL.
Yeah, and there's a whole market for that with like meme culture, and people's comedy taste is changing. People don't want to talk about what it was like to be a kid. Younger people don't want to talk about that. They want to talk about gibberish.
They want to do a bit about tables.
Yeah, they want to talk about table.
What's her job? It's tables.
Yeah, I don't know, but I think that's what I always found funny. So I never try to talk about anything. I try to talk about nothing. It's nothing of it has any substance whatsoever. It's all gibberish.
What do you read, though? Because you said it's a little bit of it's philosophical, so maybe it does have substance.
Well, yes, meaning in the meaningless, yeah. I read a fair amount of, Nietzsche and...
No substance.
No substance, and... just a lot of different things. I read a lot of nihilism, like antinatalist, like Rust Cole type shit, like where like human existence is like meaningless kind of, which I guess is, what is the name for that? Is that
wouldn't it be nihilism?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like existential nihilism. So, yeah, but I mean, I generally subscribe to, I'm just an absurdist. So I just try to, it's meaning in the meaningless by not saying anything or saying something, I guess, if I had to put a label to it. But I don't really think in those terms. Like when I'm structuring the hour, I'm not really trying to say anything. And in the process of saying something, yes. Interesting to think about, especially around the holiday. But.
Which holidays? Like President's Day?
President's Day. Oh, man. Arbor Day. Memorial Day weekend.
6 months from now.
God, it's coming up quick.
I fucking wish. It's you're also a big, I mean, you're a big culture guy, as evidenced by the t-shirts that you wear.
Yeah.
Which is how we know each other.
Yes. Because
you bought my t-shirts and I was like, oh, that guy. I know who that guy is. I saw you like on a clip and I was like, wait, I fucking made that. I designed that in my store. But like a lot of your shirts are specifically culture related, and a lot of them are horror movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Big horror guy?
Oh, huge horror guy. Yeah.
So big horror, big nihilism, and you're in comedy.
Well, you know, life's not all funny, right? Life's not all funny, but it's not all sad either. So I think as much as I want to be Rust Cole from True Detective, I'm not that guy. I'm that guy maybe when I'm drinking. I'll walk around being negative and weird and unpredictable. But as like a, you know, except for the Kratom, like a sober guy, I don't think that way. Like, and I've had a really difficult life, most of it by my own doing, just being addicted to drugs and experiencing truly the dregs of society with no hope and living on the streets and not having any money and being in pain all the time and these things that kind of make you see the world as a cold and harsh place that I typically am a glass half full type person. So I'm always smiling and I'm always laughing and I love to make people laugh. Right. But there's sort of that duality, man. But when it comes to media, yeah, I typically like to watch more dramatic things. I don't really watch comedy or anything.
Well, one of the things I noticed by showing like movies on the big screen, like we showed Dirty Harry. I've seen that movie 15 times on a TV. And I saw it on the big screen and I was like, this movie's fucking hilarious.
Uh-huh.
I never noticed the jokes in here. You know what I mean? It's like the funniest movie where like a 14-year-old girl gets raped and killed. Like, legitimately, oh, there's a bunch of fucking jokes in that movie.
Well, True Detective is hilarious too, not to keep harping on that. But the more you watch things, the more you're like, oh, this is actually fucking hilarious. Yeah.
I think the best things often...
is a mix.
Yeah, because like life has both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see The Curse? Emma Stone, mm-hmm. Nathan Fielder?
Yeah.
That shit was fucking nuts.
Yeah.
But I think that also like speaks to an absurdist thing.
Yeah, well, you can't have one without the other. The best horror movies have really good comedic breaks in that tension, because it can't be all tension, right? With the exception of maybe like the Safdie brothers doing what they do with Uncut Gems and Good Time and things like that.
And but, also The Curse.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, yeah. Because life is, you can't have tension without that tension being snapped and broken, right? So, and my hours, very similar. I'll be like, quote unquote, like crushing. I have jokes that do really well, and then I'll purposefully have people not laughing for several minutes, right? Because I have bits that are more dramatic things that aren't necessarily even funny. Because I don't even like being funny all the time. So it's an expression of that. I want people to be laughing 99% of the time, but also it's fun to do super dramatic things where people Kaufman-esque things where everyone's just going, why is this happening? Like, we were having so much fun, why have you done this?
Why are you taking us?
Yeah, why have you chose to do this, right? And that I think is the artistry of it, not for myself but in other pieces, of choosing not to do something, right? You can continue to laugh, but I'm choosing not to let you, right? That's an interesting point, and that's where it sort of has more merit.
There's a Hitchcock theory on suspense.
Yeah.
And it's like two ways to shoot a scene. And it's two people at a table talking about baseball and a bomb explodes. And if you just shoot it that way, it's like shocking. But if there's two people at a table talking about baseball and the audience knows there's a bomb and then it explodes, that's suspenseful.
Yes.
Right? So it's like actively choosing which way you're trying. Both are valid. Mm-hmm. Depending on the goal you're trying to, like, you know, if you're starting a movie, first way is great. You want to shock people, draw them in.
Yeah.
But if you're in the middle of a fucking thing, you want to build and build and build until the release.
Yes.
Comedy is real fucking similar.
Yes.
Without a bomb exploding.
Well, you need silence to have laughter, right? Interesting concept. Yes, especially around the holidays. But also, I say this, and I hope I'm not sounding pretentious, because most of the things I talk about are like worms. So I'm certainly not like some Perhaps. Academic mind, but when you do it for a living and you do 2 hours a night, 4 or 5 days a week, you do think about it and you have a lot of time to think about what you're doing and what your legacy will be and what you're trying to present, right? So I do think about these things, even though I'm up there talking about worms and Donnie Darko and these sort of silly, goofy things.
Well, is it like when you... When you're putting an hour together, because seemingly from listening to comedians talk, there's like a trajectory of like you get 5, then you can do 15, mm-hmm. you can open for 20.
Yes.
And then you have like an hour, and you're like an hour guy, do a solid
thing. Yeah.
how'd you make the jump? B, is an hour fucking hard? That's like a lot of time to it just be you.
Well, there's beats to it, right? And also, I've done it for 10 years. So for 5 of those years, I probably didn't have a good 10 minutes. But then the ball like starts rolling. And then you start looking at your older stuff now that you have. Because so much of being on stage is just learning how to keep people's attention, even if you're not being funny. And when I was eating shit in Boise, people were paying attention. And I learned how to speak even when no one was laughing. And I think Rory Scovel says something, this is something I've heard secondhand, but it's something along the lines of don't be afraid of the silence. So it's like, if you can talk when no one's laughing, then you can really talk while people are laughing. So it's that idea of, it's easy. I think getting 30 is the hardest. Getting up to 30 good minutes.
Like taking the jump from like 5 to 30.
Yeah, that's the hardest. Because then you're really, it's bit by bit by bit. You're like, okay, I'm about 7. You can feel you're about 7 minutes into your set. And then this story is about 10 minutes. And then maybe the last 10 minutes, you're kind of fucking around to eat up time. Because when you're first headlining, so much of it is just eating time. You typically need to do about 40 minutes if you're headlining a show. You could do less, but people are paying money. You need to give them about 40 minutes.
I saw Sandler do 3 hours.
Yeah. I'll do an hour 15 sometimes. I'll do an hour 20. But this is, it's new to me. The headlining, like the bigger shows, is new to me. Because even 2 years ago, I couldn't sell any fucking tickets. So,
what changed? Yeah.
It's something that you're always working at. My clips, just stuff got more popular online, my social media stuff. Kill Tony helped a lot. And then from that, people started looking at like my old YouTube stuff. And then also there's a bunch of accounts that just post my shit.
That weird?
It was really, I was really uncomfortable with it about a year ago. It was like driving me, it was all I could think about because I'm not chronically online. Like I'll post on Instagram and I delete it for a couple days. Like I don't look at it, but the idea that people were out there posting and watching and commenting on things that I did, like maybe even years ago, it was like keeping me up at night. I was like, oh, I should have changed those jokes. I should have never put that online. Like all these things were driving me insane because it's people sharing your thoughts without your permission, right? They're not texting you and going, hey, can I share this? They're taking all your stuff and running with it.
Making the whole fucking account off.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like Casey Rock Eclipse accounts and they're all over TikTok and stuff. But it's been nothing but positive now. Because now people see it and they become your fan even without you doing anything except for the act. So it's been super positive. But it was, dude, I was in such a bad place with it like a year ago. It was just not. Because I don't know if I ever even really wanted to be popular. I just wanted to do what I was doing. It was all about the act. It's all about the jokes. And I never wanted any of the fame stuff. So.
It's really odd. And this has happened to me. And I imagine it happens to you more because your brand is you.
Yeah.
And your face and your act. Where like you're out somewhere and someone comes up to you. And they're like, I know who you are. And yes. You're looking at them and you're like,
I don't know.
Weird, dude.
Yeah, I know. Well, that has really taken some getting used to.
And you got
to
play like the fucking character that they want.
Well, you just get used to it. I'm a super nice guy. So I think that glass half full thing generally extends to I'm happy to talk to anybody. Because most of my life, no one wanted to talk to me. No one knew who I was. So it's a positive thing. My comedy is positive. Brody Stevens, positive energy. Yes, it's a good thing, and it's a force of change in a positive way, and it makes people happy, and it's a good way to spend their time. So I try to look at it in a good way. But, yeah, I'll be in a restaurant, and people are staring at me, and I'm like, why is that fucking guy staring at me? Like, it'll, like, start making me mad, and I'm like, oh, no, he knows me from the thing. I'll be in the airport, some fucking bozo staring at me, like, what is this piece of shit? Why is this guy staring at me? They're like, oh, he likes me. Or at least he knows who I am.
He's already created a relationship with me.
Yeah, because they know that is something I think about all the time. They know you.
Yeah.
They know a lot about you. They think they do. But you don't know them at all. You've never met them, which is a weird
it's fucking far out strange. Concept. And then sometimes you can do stuff that makes them angry because it breaks their idea of what you would do. You know, like I've had people comment on stuff I post and be like, this is supposed to be a company about good music. And it's like, no, dude, it's supposed to be whatever. It's me.
Yeah.
Whatever the fuck I want it
whatever
to be.
Whatever I want. Yeah.
That's what it's supposed to be. You're along for the ride, man.
And we have such a, like, especially with music stuff, would be a weird thing to feel that way. Because I love, like, Waylon and Willie and Towns and Johnny Paycheck. But I also love, like, Sufjan Stevens and Joni Mitchell. And I love this girl. I love the B-52s. But I also love Lynyrd Skynyrd, you know? So I Black Sabbath. I fucking love, like, heavy, heavy, dark shit. But I also love, like, Joan Baez. So, you know, I like all these different things. And
Joni Mitchell can get a little dark.
Sure. Yeah. Like, she can.
Hejira, which the album the name I can never pronounce. That's a little fucking heavy at points.
Yeah.
You know, but it has both sides of the equation. Also, all the people that you named, I think about this a lot, is when you listen to them, it's not like a genre. You can listen to Joni Mitchell and be like, well, that's Joni Mitchell music.
Yeah.
Neil Young, that's Neil Young music. Lynyrd Skynyrd, that's Lynyrd Skynyrd. There's a lot of Southern rock bands, but that's Lynyrd Skynyrd music.
Oh, yeah.
You and know?
That's great. It's a singular artistic voice, and we're all made up of all these different things. Yeah. I have moments where it's the blues, and then I have moments where it's the B-52s.
But even in blues, like, you can listen to Howlin' Wolf and then Albert King, and they're entirely different.
Mm-hmm.
But you can listen to a guy in a shitty bar and be like, that's the blues. That's not you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Junior Kimbrell is totally different from Lightning Hopkins. Yeah. These things are.
And that's what they make. They don't have genres. Because, like, sometimes I'll be like, I want to listen to another band like Little Feat. I'll be like, fuck.
Yeah.
I Lil George solo records, you know?
Oh, the best things are like that. Yeah. And I think my comedy is always informed with that in mind. I don't want to, I go out of my way, which is so frustrating if people ever comment that it's like anything else, because I spend so much time trying to make it whatever specifically I would think is funny, with the verbiage being something totally unique to me, and going so far as to text Sam Talent, text these people that are even somewhat adjacent.
That guy's funny.
Sam's so great.
I saw him for the first time on Viceland on Flophouse in 2016.
Dude, he's a genius. If you want to do anything with improvisation on stage, Sam Talent is the only one who really is capable of doing it correctly. Him and Rory Scovel.
Dude, Rory Scovel opened a fucking special. The first special I saw of his, my wife showed it to me. She's like, this guy's hilarious. His first 5 minutes were him just saying, y'all do anal.
Uh-huh.
In a Southern accent.
Yeah, I saw him do his improvised specials at Relapse Theater in Atlanta. That was when I was living in Georgia. So I got to watch him do two nights of every show is completely improvised from start to finish, which is something like nobody does, obviously. And it's just masterful to get the beats of an hour while it all being completely improvised, because you have to take them on a journey, right?
Yeah.
You have to take them on with tension and things. And when you can structure your hour, it's easier when you run it 200 times a year. It's easier to go, this part should go at the beginning, this part should go at the end. But when you're making it up on the spot, I mean, he's truly like it's like an orchestra. It's incredible.
Have you seen Todd Barry's crowd work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was thinking about the other day how, like, if that had come out now.
Yeah.
Now that all of the internet with comedy is fucking crowd work.
Mm-hmm.
But that was like 2015, and people were like, weird.
Uh-huh. It was like a novelty thing.
Yeah, they were like, oh, that's goofy. Who does that?
Yeah.
But that's one of my favorite fucking specials of all time.
He's so great, man. He's a great actor, too.
Dude, I love Todd Barry.
He's in The Wrestler.
Yeah, that guy cracks me. He's one of the people,
he's
like,
funny,
Norm,
dude. Yeah.
Where there's, like, no joke.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying it, so it's a joke. Steve Martin's like that.
Nate Bargatze.
Yeah, you're like, that's not fucking funny. Just, like, just sitting here reading the words, that doesn't land.
It's a cadence thing.
Yeah. Right?
So much of it is timing and how you're drawing out your words. And, I mean, these things, it's a lifelong endeavor. Like, that jump from feature to headliner is just crazy. Like, what it takes to really, truly control an audience. And you think you're doing it.
I imagine a lot of people miss that jump. Like, that's where most people top out is feature.
Well, for good, like, you know, not all music is capable of being in arenas or whatever, or carrying an audience, you know, and some bands have one good song and some comedians have one good joke, you know. So it's hard to make lightning strike a million times. You know what I mean?
Then you have Tim Heidecker going up and purposefully bombing.
Yeah, and it's fucking hilarious.
And it's funnier than most people trying.
It's hysterical. Yeah. Because, yeah, the whole idea of, like, pandering is just so funny. Because so much of stand-up, like the old Road Dogs, is like, you guys together? You know, like, so much of stand-up is like, God, when I was a kid, that did... When I was a kid, man... Come on. When I was a kid, that wasn't, come on. That wasn't even a thing. You know, like, what are we doing? What are we doing? Yeah.
I remember growing up when my dad, he told me, he grew up in the 70s and he told me about the first time he heard Red Fox.
Yeah.
Like, cause you know, most of the comedy he saw was on The Tonight Show. So it's like cleaned up.
Mm-hmm.
And he heard on a fucking record in the basement, Red Fox says, you got to wash your ass bit.
Yeah.
And he told me just about him being like, what the fuck? Like, that's what comedy is?
Yeah, that's how I felt when I saw Sam Talent. Yeah, I opened for him in Boise maybe 7 years ago, and I was doing my feature thing. I was kind of featuring, and it was all, I had jumped the shark from being completely unattainable to purposefully trying to kind of pander, and I was in a very small section of my life where I was doing that, where I was going like, kind of like y'all smoke weed material. Mm-hmm. Y'all smoke weed. And I saw him headline right after I went up and I threw out all my jokes. And I was like, I will never, ever do that ever again. I was so embarrassed. I was so embarrassed. And it had gone really good. But comedy's not about making people laugh. It's about bringing, right, making them meet you at where you are.
And
so
subversion jokes.
Yeah.
There's a Steve Martin joke.
You don't want to be relatable.
Well, like one of my favorite jokes is Steve Martin. This is back in the 70s. So, like, with the context, you know, I always like thinking about context of when things came out. Like, Citizen Kane now is not nuts, but in 1942 it is. You know, like, it's a weird way to shoot a movie. But he has this joke where he's talking about going home with this girl, and he's like, you know, he's got the best pussy I've ever seen. And the crowd's like, what? And, you know, he's like, well, you know, I'm talking about her cat. What are you? Uh-huh. Then he takes a drink of water, and right before he takes a fucking sip, he goes, cat was the best fuck of my life, though. And, like, that's a perfect joke to me.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing funny until it fucking breaks, and it's the funniest fucking thing you've ever heard.
For sure. Yeah, and something about that... Yeah, because you think it's going one way, and then
you think it's bombing.
Yeah, and you're like, oh man, why is he? This doesn't seem like him to be talking about that. Yeah,
and like with him, it doesn't seem like him to talk about fucking a cat.
No,
so it works on a lot of different levels.
Yeah, the misdirect, the old ball and hand trick.
The misdirect's the best part of comedy.
Yeah,
but where do you see yourself going? Do you have a plan?
Well, it's always changing. Like, with the headlining stuff, I was meaning to say earlier, like, this time last year, I filmed a special. And I thought it was, and I had only been headlining for maybe a year or two. And I was like, oh, this is the hour. This is the hour I've been doing. And I don't do any of those jokes anymore. And I didn't put the special out. Because I was watching it, and I was like, this just isn't ready. This is not what the quote-unquote vision would be. And that what that is changes every day, and it changes every hour. So, and I think specials is a difficult thing to capture anyways, because it's not like music. It's different. And the beats of one joke may be better one night to how you normally tell them. It's so hard to capture that perfect thing. But yeah, like where I was last year, I thought I was already doing it. And then now it's in a completely different place. So I don't really know. It's a lot of gags. It's a lot of hidden things, like literally around the room, like proppy type stuff. It's a lot of, I don't know, maybe it'll take more of a media turn with like things on screens and things, but it's just always expanding. And we're in such a unique landscape for it, because now more comedians are doing that than ever before.
Comedy got fucking huge.
Yeah. And now you can't, like Connor O'Malley and these people who are doing great stuff with like slideshows and things like that, and I think that's really great. I think maybe I could do that for like a later special or something, because that just really opens the doors of what it could be. It was such a limiting art form, and it used to frustrate me so much with, there's only so much you can do with words, right? And it could be so much funnier with other things.
It was, again, there's a Todd Barry special where he ends it by reading an article about what you're supposed to do when you're trying to hook up with a lady.
Uh-huh.
You know, from a lady's point of view. And it's just him reading the fucking article.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And Mulaney, he ended his last one with him reading something. And it was so funny. I can't
the interview he gave.
Yes. Where he's coked out or something. Oh, my God. Like, so good.
Don't worry about that. I just dropped my cereal.
Yeah. He's eating fucking cereal. Oh, my God.
Walking
so
by a
funny.
House thinking it's haunted, looking it up and being like, and I was totally right. Like, I went in the rehab 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
That's also a nuts special, because it's it's like it's a serious topic.
Yeah, and it's almost like a concept album. Like, of course, stand-up is inherently concept-driven, right, with jokes and things like that. So it's not like music in that way. But it's all about the rehab, right? So there's just so much you can do, you know. I want to be prolific. I don't want to get caught up with doing jokes that people know, which returns kind of a callback, full circle type thing. People think they want to see the thing they love you for, but they don't. So you have to give them something new to love, which is a large undertaking.
And you got to guess. Like, when we're putting new stuff out, I'm like, well, I hope I didn't just buy 150 t-shirts nobody wants.
Exactly. Well, it's always about taking risks. And when you're I live on the road. I'm never, ever home. So when this is your entire life, it takes on a really different meaning. Like, there's so much weight. Because there has to be. My life has to have meaning. This hour has to have meaning, or else I'm just out here away from my family, can't have a girlfriend, you know. I do, but I never get to see her.
That actively goes against nihilism.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure, but we contain dualities, right? I have days where I'm like, what is the point of any of this shit? No one's going to remember it. If I drop the best special of my life, no one will remember it in 6 months. So what's the point? But it's the act of doing it that gives it meaning. Right? For a moment, it will have meaning.
You also end up with people like, not like, I have like obsessions about things, as everyone does.
Yeah.
And like, I've always been able to quote full, like, when I was growing up, I could quote full episodes of That 70s Show to my mom, and she'd be like, "That's awesome, but you can't do fucking math." And I'd be like, "Yeah, because I don't care about it."
Sure.
You know, but like, there's little clips I remember, like, Mulaney was on Pete Holmes Crashing.
Yeah.
That clip, I think about that clip where Pete is going to open for him.
Mm-hmm.
And Mulaney's just being a fucking asshole.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
I think about that about once a week. And that came out like 15 years
ago. Yeah. There's little earworms. And if you can have something that people, so in that way, you're totally right. You can have one little thing that will resonate and it will live on forever. And
I remember nothing else of Crashing.
Yeah. It may not be the thing you want it to be, but you could be so lucky to have something that will stick with people. And it's probably not the thing you think it will be.
Not the thing you hope it will be.
Yeah. You can hope, trying to say something. But it's never something you sit down and mean to do. It's just something that happens. But I think that's about all I have to say about it.
Yeah, dude. We hit exactly an hour.
Good. Well, it feels like a good place to wrap up. And again, I hope I didn't sound pretentious, because most of the things I talk about, again, are worms. So
I thought it was interesting. I got to talk about cruising, which is something I do on every fucking episode.
I'm happy to talk about it. Generally, I don't talk about comedy on podcasts because it's like, it's draining to me. But it was good. It was good to talk to you, man. And I love the shirts, and I love what you do, and I love outlaw country music. So it was good to meet you, dude. Very cool.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing it.
Big fun. And my tour dates are on caseyrocketcomedy.com. I'm going to 40 more cities this year. I'm going to the UK. I'm going to Australia. So check out my website, and I'm probably coming to a city close to you. So
And you'll maybe have a special at some point.
Maybe at the end of the year. Yeah.
Okay.
The one I recorded, I'm burying. It's just not ready, but maybe at the end of the year. Yeah.
Well, thanks, dude.
Thank you. Yeah.